أمه. While the mother of Imam Qadir, which is the wife of Imam Sadiq, was not yet conceived of Imam Qadir. So two generations before. So the father of Lady Masuma was not yet conceived, let alone Lady Masuma. Two generations before, Imam Sadiq said this about Lady Masuma. So there were many daughters of Imams. But we don't have such expressions about them. There were many sons. We don't have such expressions about them. So she has very special position. There is a hadith that is from Imam Reza alayhi salam. And I have quoted this from Nasikh al-Tawarikh and also from Rayahin al-Sharia. Imam Reza alayhi salam said, "Man zara al-ma'sumata biqum ka man zarani." Whoever visits Ma'suma in Qum has visited me. You know that Lady Masuma, after Imam Reza moved from Medina to Marv, because he was forced by Ma'mun, the Abbasid Caliph, to become his prince, his waliahd, and to move near him. He didn't want, but there was a force, and Imam said, with the condition that I don't interfere and, you know, deal with any governmental work. So after Imam Reza went from Medina to Marv, Lady Fatimatul Ma'suma, who was very close to Imam Reza, because Imam Reza and Lady Ma'suma are from the same father and the same mother, and there's a special relation. Actually, she spent maybe more time with Imam Reza because her father was in prison. So she's very attached to Imam Reza and vice versa. So she wanted to visit her brother. Of course, this is on the surface, but it is all plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So with some of the brothers, family members, lovers of Ahlul Bayt, they organized a group, a delegation, and they went towards Marv. But unfortunately, in a place called Sabe, which is a city now, they were attacked. Some people who were against Ahlul Bayt attacked them. They killed some of the men. And she was also very ill. And she asked to take her to Qum. She knew of Qum. She said, take me to Qum. And she went to Qum and she stayed in a place that, alhamdulillah, today is now preserved. Ayatollah Gulpaygan Rahmatullah made that into school, the madrasa. So she was there for a few weeks doing ibadah, and then she passed away. We mentioned the details in the book, you know, and then she was buried in this current place, which was a garden belonging to one of the Shia. There was a river here, and this was a garden next to that river. So she passed away before seeing Imam Reza alayhi salam. So about a year after Imam Reza went, she died, and Imam Reza was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, about a year alive after her demise. So when Imam Reza is alive and she has passed away, he says, "Man zara al-ma'sumata biqum ka man zara." Whoever visits Ma'suma in Qum has visited me. So this hadith also shows that Al-Ma'suma is a title that Imam Reza has used for Lady Ma'suma.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati. Ghafur Shah. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Aperture.
In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like the dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America, and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water, and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further, because in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient bleeding profusely and saying, oh, it's not so bad. When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea.
Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anani. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana. This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Councillor David Blackburn, if you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the acid tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste that have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa? Or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with it?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana. Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched as far as we can that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago. And as I say, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. Do you have anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, it's basically two teams that have gone into administration and will be taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm. All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call Odin.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses, it's been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belén and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for €2. A fridge will yield up to €10 and a system unit €4. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, €10 million. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belén's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belén's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the Gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the Gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled. But D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering three continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors had been sold for between 50 cents and €2 apiece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo and Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling company shut down. But Mobo continue to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends €130 billion a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about €40,000. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anané has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years, we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute, so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are work in order, but material sitting behind that that's not working order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use our resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to the end of this container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. We've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. But what about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity.
I'm not getting fired!
What most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler, they'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the negative concept of istikbar or arrogance, what is called global arrogance in the world. And a few countries nowadays in the 21st century are talking about opposing global arrogance. What is global arrogance? First, let's start with the definition. Sayyid Mohsen, what is global arrogance?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, according to the Friedman, he said that when a country can have influence over the people without invading it, and it can change the culture and the lifestyle of people, this is known as global arrogance.
Okay.
Because it has an influence on it, mm-hmm. without any having any kind of invasion.
Yes.
So when you are affected on the minds of the people and you're changing it without entering physically mm-hmm. into that area, this is known as global arrogance. So this definition is given by the Friedman, obviously. And later, the other scholars, the researchers, they also have accepted the same
yes.
idea.
Okay.
So this is what they generally are talking about.
Is it limited to a specific countries only in the Western world, for example? I mean, the West of the world?
In the definition, obviously, he talks about the general definition.
Uh-huh.
But when we look at the examples, the practical examples, then obviously we see the Western countries, how the capitalist regime who is ruling the USA right now has become the perfect example of this global arrogance.
Okay. So it is, I think, very much rooted in the concept of colonialism too, isn't it? For example, countries like Great Britain or France used to go here and there and colonize different countries.
But they used to go physically.
Yes, it was the physical one. Nowadays, it is usually in the thought manner, isn't it?
Through media.
Okay, and the media and the thoughts. That's right. Okay, what are the examples of arrogance or istikbar today? I mean, give us some example to know that, for example, a country is arrogant. Sheikh.
If we talk about istikbar or arrogance from the Islamic perspective, we should understand that the first mustakbir in the whole universe was Satan.
Okay.
Yeah, Satan. Because he performed istikbar against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, against the truth.
Right.
So istikbar means to deny, to reject the truth, and to force and pressurize others to accept your own ideas. While it is opposed to those people's will and those people's, let's say, lifestyles, whatever.
Very good.
So if we look at to the istikbar or kibr or arrogance from this perspective, we see that whatever country, whatever nation, if they try to force others, to pressurize others, to accept their culture, to accept their value systems, to accept their ideas, to accept their lifestyle, to follow them by forcing, by pressurizing them.
Okay.
This is called istikbar.
Okay.
But unfortunately, in the history, we had lots of examples. Mm-hmm. One of them was, for example, Alexander the Great.
Mm-hmm.
He pressurized many people, many nations, to follow the Western lifestyle.
Yes.
For example, when we attacked India.
Yes.
He forced the Indian people to become like them.
Also Persia.
Yeah, of course, Persia, of course.
Yes.
But Aristotle, who was the teacher of Alexander the Great, he was always telling him that you are making a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It is wrong. If you cannot conquer the hearts of the people, then the people will never follow you. Yeah, of course, for some days that you with your forces are there, they will follow you.
Yes.
But after that, they will forget about you.
Yes.
It happened to Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great went...
Yes.
And died, and all the armies, the forces went.
And he was killed by his own
friend.
He
was killed, of course.
Yes, yes.
But India remained India. Yes. Islamic areas remained Muslims.
Okay.
All the cultures remained the same. Same as the case was with Great Britain.
Yes.
They also pressurized many nations, many countries to change their value systems, their culture. But they couldn't, because nowadays we have Islamic world.
Okay.
We have non-Islamic world in the East and the West, all of them.
Yes.
I think, of course, nowadays maybe the United States as one of the great powers.
Sorry, before getting to the United States and his arrogance in today's world and the Israelites, you know, the people like Gandhi... In India, as you said, give us a good example. Or people like we can say Mandela in South Africa, or people like the late Imam Khomeini in Iran. Do you believe in them as the figures who were against the global arrogance or something?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, Nelson Mandela, Imam Khomeini, or Mahatma Gandhi, even in the U.S., that man, what was his
Martin
name?
Luther
Martin
King,
Luther King.
Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, of course.
And also, they were
the people who were fighting against this injustice in the world, against the discrimination in the whole world.
Very good.
That's why they are like good exemplary of these. Their lives are good exemplaries of resistance against this arrogance that they did. And they saved their people. They saved their nations. Like Imam Khomeini, like... Mahatma Gandhi and like Nelson Mandela, they saved their people, they protected their values, their culture, their people, their nation.
Okay.
This is the great role that they were played by these figures.
And the common ground between all of them is acting against injustice. It seems that arrogance and injustice juxtapose each other.
Exactly.
Or coming together
all
around the world. Regardless of the religion... or race, or color, or language, or something like that. But why nowadays we can't say Sayyid? We could see some kings of some of the Muslim lands are protecting arrogance. And there are acting arrogantly. I mean, they are hand in hand with the arrogant powers in the world. They are silent when, for example, the people of Gaza or the children in Gaza are bombarded, the people in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, here and there. Why?
Well, obviously, we need to look at the aspect, the main idea or theme behind the global arrogance or the arrogance itself. As respected guest has said, that the arrogance means that it is against the truth.
Yes.
And then it wants its words or his words to be spread in the world forcefully.
Yes.
So basically what happens is in global arrogance, when we talk about the global arrogance, the main theme is to spread hatred in the world.
Yes.
So that there can be wars or anything, so that people are involved in these activities and we can rule over the world. This is the main idea behind it. So basically, they are inciting the hatred in the world.
Yes.
Which has been changed to the Muslim phobia, like they are now propagating against the Muslim ummah.
Or the whole akhlaqi system, isn't it?
They're against all this. They're against all these things.
Yes.
The main idea is, when we look at the basic philosophy behind it, or basic, we can say, like regime or system behind it, we find capitalism, for example.
Yes, secularism, capitalism.
Now, capitalism, when you look at the capitalism, there are three main things. Number one, you are free to use any means in order to increase your wealth. Even if you have to make people slave, even if you have to kill people, even if you have to not to give people their rights, even if the poor become poorer and the rich become richer.
Okay.
And in this game, in this competition, if there are some people who comes to the market and they cannot survive, it is better than they die. Which we have seen the same idea in the corona. Some people were talking about these things, let the poor people die.
Yes.
When there was food crisis, they say it is their right to have food crisis so that they die and we can live. So this is the idea basically behind it. And this is all global arrogance, obviously.
Yes.
They're leading this global arrogance.
Okay.
On the other hand, when they are...
Some of their extremists say, in order to save this world, let's kill the people.
Let's kill the
people. Because over the population, they are using the benefits and the sources all around the world.
So
they are doing that, really.
What is the problem? Okay. The problem is these sources are being shared with the people, and they do not own it. Because they want to own it. And this greed, basically, this greed has taken them to this point. So these are all the, we can say, like characteristics of being arrogant.
That's right.
And in the global arrogance, what we see, even in the Muslim countries, is because they themselves cannot decide.
Yes.
Number one. Number two, they have accepted some countries who are spreading the global arrogance, and they are the examples of the global arrogance as their masters. So whatever they do, they will follow them. That's why we see today in the Muslim countries, there are some kings, they are silent on the people. Like when the Yemeni people are being killed, the children in the Palestine, in other parts of the world, in Myanmar, I don't know, in Kashmir. We have so many places. There are many people who are poor, who they can help, but they're not helping them.
Yes.
They're just having their own life, making their own wealth more and more.
Yes.
So all these things are because that they are following the path of those who are the perfect example of global arrogance. On the other hand, because Islam is against this. Islam is against hatred.
Yes.
Islam is not inciting hatred. It's the global arrogance that is inciting. So because Islam has become a religion or a school of thought that is against injustice, that is against the any kind of global arrogance, that's why now they're trying to fight against the Islam.
That's
and
right.
The Muslim Ummah is becoming the oppressed ones at the moment.
And I think beside the Muslim Ummah, all the believers, because, you know, inside Christianity, we could find so many justice, freedom seekers, truth seekers all across the world, also inside Judaism. For example, the interesting cases about the Judaism who are criticizing the Zionist regime, okay, for the cruelties that they are doing all across the world. And I think the truth seekers all across the world think that this network of arrogance is working everywhere. I mean, the branches, like an international, we can say, company, who has branches all over the world.
Okay. So the first thing is you're free, number one. So this freedom means that even if you want to make slaves and all those, you're free. Number two, that you can own anything, anything. For example, if someone is living in a farm, you have the power, you go there, and you take over it, you kick out the original, you know, the owner of the farm, and if you can hold it with the power that you have, you become the owner. Unlimited ownership, which is even against Islam, because وَلِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ. This is the Islamic concept. Everything which is on this, between the earth and the skies, is it is all for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he has to give the rights to the people. So others has also right to live. But this is the second thing. That the
like a slavery in the United States, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, obviously.
The apartheid and, you know, the slavery and the colored people who were burnt alive, you know? The U.S., who is the main, we can say, protector of human rights nowadays, just look at his history, not very much long ago, 70 years ago. The picture of the people who considered colored people equal to animals, separated the bus system in order to sit down, burning the people alive in the streets. You know, this is the shocking history of the U.S., okay?
So obviously these are, why? Because these are rooted in capitalism.
Yes.
And that's the main thing. When the capitalist regime has taken over the rulership of U.S., obviously they have applied their own rules. On the other hand, with the passage of time, because the human rights have entered into the, you know, the global, we can say, like
arena.
Arena.
Yes.
That's why they're limited. They limited them. Otherwise, they would have done this for, you know, many times ago. So the ownership, which we know as Malikiyat.
Yes.
That is, so one is the freedom, the second is Malikiyat, and the third is you can use any tools.
Yes.
They did it. Unlimited tools.
They did it on Hiroshima. They did it on Vietnam.
So
okay.
All these things, these three things are the main roots of the capitalism.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid. Welcome. Can we defend ourselves with guns or, I don't know, we can't say against global arrogance? Or nowadays the system has changed, Shaykh. It is really a soft war nowadays. As Joseph Nye, you said, the outstanding politician and the, we can't say, because ideologists of politics has said, call it. It is the soft power and the soft war now, isn't it?
I think If we want to protect ourselves against this kind of arrogance, both software and hardware we need.
Okay.
As they colonized all the nations with both of them, they first trying to teach the children, the different generations of those nations with their own teachings, doctrines and values.
Yes.
And then they were attacking force by force the areas, the lands that they conquered, and they usurped all those materials or those properties of the nations.
Yes.
So it is that really happened in Africa, in Asia, in Australia, in Canada, in all these areas. They attacked and usurped all the things and murdered.
Yes, murdered
hundreds of thousands of people.
Yes,
that nowadays you do not see the original people of Australia, original people of Canada.
No,
we do not see them.
We see. Recently they found in Canada, you know, so many native speakers and children who were buried alive.
Alive,
You know, and this nowadays the cemeteries and the graves are found. And the Canada is talking about human rights, for example, in Iran or in Bahrain or Afghanistan or here and there, okay?
Yeah. The Britain wanted to do the same thing with Afghanistan because they three times attacked in the last century, Afghanistan, to conquer, to kill, to murder all the people, but the people defended themselves.
That's
so anyhow, that was the case in India and other areas. Okay. I think that's why if we want to protect ourselves against these arrogant powers, of course, both software and hardware we need.
That's right.
That's why I think nowadays, for example, if Islamic Republic of Iran...
Yes.
If this country did not strengthen themselves powerfully in terms of arms, they would not do anything against it.
No.
So it's the same. I mean, both things are we need.
That's right.
We need of, yes.
You know, there is a main idea behind it. Obviously, the places which, dear guest, and you have mentioned, obviously why these countries are going after them. It's because of the resources.
Resources, yes.
The natural resources. The countries, they do not have any kind of resources, they're not going after them. You know, they are free.
Yes.
They have nothing to do with them.
Yes.
Okay. And even the countries that have, even if they're their neighbors, they have the same idea.
Right.
For example, U.S. is controlling Canada as well.
U.S., yes.
Because of the oil. So we have all these examples. All these things are happening because of all.
The milking cow.
Yeah. The milking cow have refused to give oil, and then the U.S. is
this
bringing more.
This is really a disgrace for a country
that the president is sitting down by a king and in front of them call them you milking cow.
Yeah, a president saying to king.
A president saying to a king that we are milking you like a cow. Wow, this is really a disgrace for that country. Okay. Alhamdulillah, the Jabhatul Haq is really successful. It will be victorious by the reappearance of Imam Asr, inshallah, against this camp of battle. And this is the promise of Allah in the Holy Quran. This is not just a simple promise given by this president or that president. This has been the promise of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to all the truth seekers across the world. Thank you much, Sayyid, and thank you much, Sheikh, for talking about the concept of al-istikbar and how to oppose global arrogance in the world today. It was very kind of you. Thank you much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, salamun alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have an interesting story, and I invite you to listen to it. The title of today's story is The Magic of Thinking Big. Several years ago, I witnessed an exceptionally impressive sales meeting The vice president in charge of marketing for this company was tremendously excited. He wanted to drive home a point. He had with him on the platform the leading representative in the organization, a very ordinary-looking fellow who earned the year just and just a little under $60,000. The earnings of other representatives averaged $12,000. The executive challenged the group. Here is what he said. I want you to take a good look at Harry. Look at him. Now, what's Harry got that the rest of you haven't? Harry earned 5 times the average, but is Harry 5 times smarter? No, not according to our personnel tests. I checked. They show he's about average in that department. And did Harry work 5 times harder than you fellows? No, not according to the reports. He took more time off than most of you. Did Harry have a better territory? Again, I've got to say no. The counts averaged about the same. Did Harry have more education? Better health? Again, no. Harry's about as an average guy could be, except for one thing. The difference between Harry and the rest of you, said the vice president, the difference is that Harry thought 5 times bigger. Then the executive proceeded to show that success is determined not so much by the size of one's brain as it is by the size of one's thinking. This was an intriguing thought, and it stayed with me. The more I observe, the more people I talk with, the deeper I dug into what's really behind success, the clearer the answer. Case history after case history proved that the size of bank accounts, the size of happiness accounts, and the size of one's general satisfaction account are dependent on the size of one's thinking. There is magic in thinking big. We'll learn more about this story after a break.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to this another show of Lantern from IAB English Radio. In this show, we are going to talk about the difference between foresight and long dreams. Foresight is a type of planning that every wise person needs, because everyone should think about the necessity, because everyone should think about the necessary measures for his future life. Measure the ups and downs of the work and do the necessary consultation, then plan a comprehensive and workable plan according to all of these consultations that he received from different people and try to implement them. But the long dreams and long desires have been condemned in the narrations, and they are the same imaginary and sensual ambitions that make people busy and neglectful. Foresight and planning for the future gives people peace and hope in life. It brings mental and spiritual vitality, but long hopes and dreams keep longing and reaching for unreasonable things in the heart and makes life bitter and destroys peace. In our religious teachings, collecting wealth and capital and savings is approved with the purpose of sacrifice and service to the people and to achieve the pleasure of God, or for charity and beneficence to the others. It is also approved for the purpose of making people independent from others and preserving one's self-esteem. So we want to say what we are talking about foresight is quite different with what we have in what we know about long dreams and, let's say, long desires. So this collecting money and wealth and capital can be seen in either two ways. If this is with the purpose of serving the servants of God, so it is highly respected. But when it goes to personal affairs of a person and to just accumulate wealth and capital, it becomes something which is not approved and accepted. What is rejected from the viewpoint of Islam, and which is one of the examples of long dreams and wishes, is wealth accumulation that I actually referred to. So we mean that competition in abundance and increase of wealth is not accepted and not approved. But when, as I said earlier, when it is being done for the sake of God, to help others, to sacrifice it to those who are in need, and whether they are poor or needy, so it becomes something, another totally different concept. It is obvious that a lot of wealth gathering has no motive other than the evil desires or arrogance and pride. Therefore, because we have seen the cases and the examples and the people who are afflicted with this, and we are seeing them even today in our daily lives. The rich people of the world, I mean, when they just enumerate and enlist them in newspapers and the magazines, and they just are proud of what they have, what they own. And they want, every year they are actually rated based on the, let's say, the highest capital that they have accumulated. Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Therefore, the savings that are provided for a lot of wealth and honor out of pride and honor will become a source of neglect, become a source of negligence and pride of the person. And Islam has a negative opinion on it. But we have to emphasize this point, that Islam is not against prosperity and comfort of the man, but this prosperity is approved to the extent that the spiritual supports are not destroyed. In the light of prosperity, material efforts are acceptable to the extent that the Muslim striver can reach the true giver of blessing, that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and thank Him for His blessings from material goods and supplies. So you see, I want to ask the respected listeners not to judge what we are saying. I want to invite the respected listeners to judge us very fairly. So we are talking about accumulating wealth and capital. We said that there are two different, perspective towards these two. It can be a good action because it is going to serve the servants of God, and it is going to be sacrificed for the sake of God with a pure intention. But if it is going to be collected with the intention of accumulating money and wealth just to have the arrogance and pride of it, so it is totally rejected. In order to clarify the topic, that is the limits of long-term wishes and its difference with the future vision, because what we are talking about, foresight or future vision, is exactly accumulating money with that divine purpose and divine intention. First, we have to look at the status of property, wealth, and economic efforts in religious teachings. Then at the definition of long-term wishes from the perspective of ethical scholars. Then we will understand the issue of foresight and savings from the perspective of verses of the Holy Quran and the traditions of the Holy Prophet and in the and infallibles. So I hope that you find this show beneficial, and I'd like to invite you to listen to us in our upcoming sessions where we shall talk about some other issues. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.